Shalom, I'm Benjamin Summer, a professor of Bible at JTS, and this is the Rabbinical Assembly's Chodesh Tov. I'd like to talk today about the legacy of three biblical scholars whom we lost not long ago: Yochanan Mufs, Jacob Milgram, and Moshe Greenberg, Zichronam Livracha. These three scholars, all of them conservative rabbis, were close both personally and professionally for many decades. Uvemotam lo nifradu, they all died within about 7 months of each other. I assume that the RA members listening to this are familiar with some of their work. Indeed, many of you probably studied with one of them, or even perhaps all of them, so I won't summarize their work. Rather, in this Chodesh Tov podcast, I'll step back to talk about how they relate to the larger field of biblical studies, and also how they transformed it. These three biblical scholars, I think, shared a single intellectual project. Their goal, throughout their scholarly careers, was twofold. As Jewish biblical scholars, they wanted to reclaim the Bible as a Jewish book. And, as scholars of the humanities, they wanted to reclaim the Bible as an interesting book. To see what I mean by this, it will be helpful to see the ways in which Professors Mufs, Greenberg, and Milgram reacted against biblical scholarship that preceded them. So let me first describe some characteristics of biblical criticism as it existed before the 1970s. First, it's useful to note that biblical criticism as an academic field at universities and seminaries emerged in the 19th century in Central and Western Europe, and in the beginning, biblical criticism was almost entirely a Protestant pursuit. Neither Catholics nor Jews were involved in this field in any significant numbers. Second, from the 19th century onward, and even as more Jews began to enter the guild of biblical scholarship in the mid-20th century, biblical criticism has often made a strong divide between the Bible and Judaism as we know it. The core of biblical criticism might be described in this way. We biblical critics don't necessarily accept classical Jewish or Christian interpretations of the Bible. Just because Rashi or Augustine said that this passage or that verse has a particular meaning, it doesn't follow that the original audience of the text understood it that way. Rather than seeing the Bible through the eyes of the rabbis or the church fathers, modern biblical critics attempt to see the Bible in the context of its own cultural world, which is the ancient Near East. That's why we spend so much time in grad school learning Ugaritic and Akkadian and immersing ourselves in the cultures of ancient Canaan, Babylonia, Assyria, and so forth. Now, this is a worthy goal, but many biblical scholars took these goals further, insisting that the Bible isn't really a Jewish book at all, and sometimes insisting that it isn't a Christian book either. Since it's an ancient Near Eastern book, it cannot also be a Jewish book. For these biblical critics, it's got to be an either-or. Many biblical critics, both Jewish and Christian, have created a firewall between biblical religion and Jewish culture. These scholars insist that it's illegitimate to use rabbinic lenses to look at the Bible. It's pointless to use rabbinic commentaries. It's perverse to think about the Bible in terms of classical Jewish ideas or values. Now, religiously, there are two interesting points to make about this perspective and how it relates to medieval points of view. First, this way of thinking among modern biblical critics is not really new. It's not an invention of the modern world. It's really just a new form of anti-Jewish supersessionism. What's bizarre is that so many Jewish biblical critics have bought into it. Second, this way of thinking meshes surprisingly well with the attitude of those elements in rabbinic culture in the Middle Ages and the modern world that downplayed the importance of biblical study. After all, a correlate to the view that biblical critics shouldn't look at the Bible as part of Judaism might be that a student of Judaism need not look at the Bible for instruction. Judaism, in this way of thinking, begins in the late Second Temple period, or even in the Mishnah. Now, let me mention one final characteristic of biblical criticism in the pre-Mufs, Greenberg, Milgram era. Biblical criticism has tended to portray the Bible as much less interesting than we usually think it is. Less interesting humanistically, theologically, and existentially. We see this, for example, in the obsession that some biblical critics have with etiology, with claiming that Genesis chapter 1 is nothing more than an attempt to explain the peculiar Israelite habit of not working every 7 days, or Genesis 11 is just an etiology explaining the origins of many languages. These kind of critics, and there are many of them still today, regard the Bible as simply much less profound than we usually tend to think of it. How would a religious Jew of any sort or a religious Christian react to this kind of biblical criticism? One might reject biblical criticism, or one might reject the Bible as a Jewish or Christian religious document. Starting in the 1960s and 1970s, I think that we see several Jewish and Christian scholars refusing to accept that dichotomy, either reject the Bible or reject biblical criticism. You see this in the work of Brevard Childs and James Barr, in the work of literary scholars like Robert Alter, Meir Weiss, and James Muhlenberg, and you also see it in a distinctive way in the work of the three Jewish scholars I'm discussing today. They responded in a way that strongly reflects the education that they received as rabbinical students at JTS and the positive historical hashkafa that they imbibed here. Now, with all this background, let's look at a few core ideas in the work of our three scholars. They expressed ideas, they were guided by notions that at the time seemed very unusual for a biblical critic to express, especially biblical critics so deeply trained in ancient Near Eastern studies as these three were. They regard the Bible as a book of important Jewish value and a book of important existential value. How do you see this, for example, in the work of Milgram? If you pick up Milgram's commentaries, it's immediately clear that he's making the point that there's a continuity between the Bible and Jewish culture in precisely the same way that there's a continuity between the Bible and ancient Near Eastern culture. Milgram pays attention to rabbinic literature in the same way that he pays attention to Akkadian, Ugaritic, and Hittite literature. Milgram places the Bible on a long trajectory, a trajectory that moves in both directions. If Akkadian literature from 1,000 years before the time of the Bible is relevant for understanding the Bible, then so too, and in precisely the same way, rabbinic literature from 1,000 years after the time of the Bible can shed light on our understanding of the Bible itself. You also see that Milgram emphasizes ethics and values, especially in priestly literature, in the P document, precisely where German biblical critics like Wellhausen argued that there were no ethics and were no values. For example, he emphasizes that, as Milgram emphasizes, that the idea of teshuvah shows up very prominently in priestly literature, where it goes under the verb ashem, to feel actually ashamed, to feel regret for what one has done. He points out that the P literature emphasizes the communal effect of a personal action, of an individual's sin. The chatat offering doesn't get rid of the guilt of an individual, of the individual who committed the act that led to the need for a chatat offering. Rather, Milgram shows, for P, the chatat offering purifies the altar, which is a concern of all Israelites. The chatat offering is not about the sinner's own guilt, it's about alleviating the negative effects of the sinner's action on the community as a whole, that is, on the community's temple, on the community's altar. A core value that he emphasizes within priestly literature is the idea of democracy within a hierarchy. The purpose of the petil techelet on the tzitz worn by the high priest and on the tzitzit worn by all Israelites, Milgram famously argues, is to bring a high priestly status to all Israelites, so that the idea of hierarchy within priestly literature leads to an idea of the democratizing of that hierarchy. Milgram acts as what we might call a textual anthropologist when he shows us that P's rituals are a religious and ethical language. Religious rituals express core Jewish and humanistic values through symbolic action. These values are relevant to and congruent with the religious system of rabbinic Judaism. In making these claims, Milgram was disagreeing with the entire Wellhausian structure of pre-1970s biblical criticism, and not only regarding the dating of the P document. Rather, Milgram was showing that priestly ritual deals with issues of guilt, forgiveness, the communal implications of individual action, with notions of divine transcendence and immanence, and above all, with grace. He's showing that P is theologically interesting. And he's showing that P is Jewish. Here, Milgram agrees with Wellhausen, who also regards P as Jewish, but Milgram takes this characteristic in a totally different direction. For Milgram, unlike Wellhausen, Jewish doesn't mean committed to childish and meaningless rituals. Rather, Jewish means expressing core humanistic and religious values through ritual. These same characteristics are present, even more deeply, though more subtly, in the work of Yohanan Mufs. I'll take as my example his book, The Personhood of God, though similar points might be made of other works of his, especially his essay, Bein Din L'Rachamin, Tefilatan Shel Nevi'im. In his analysis of the biblical God, Mufs delivers a surprise. He argues that the personal, emotional God of the Bible is more monotheistic, not less monotheistic, than the God of rationalist philosophers. In making this analysis in his surprisingly readable book, The Personhood of God, Mufs manages to synthesize the teachings of two modern Jewish figures, both of them important Jewish thinkers and biblical exegetes, Yechezkel Kaufman and Abraham Joshua Heschel. These two figures stand at opposite ends of the spectrum that is Jewish thought, and one would have assumed that they could no more be synthesized than sodium and water. But Mufs presents a nuanced version of Kaufman's thought that is more supple, more flexible, more supportable than the somewhat brittle and polemical version that Kaufman himself presented in Toldot HaEmunah HaYisraelit. Anyone who has read both Kaufman and Heschel know what an accomplishment it is to harmonize them and why it's important to constructive Jewish thought to do so. Moreover, when one pauses to think of the intellectual and spiritual genealogies of Kaufman and Heschel, one realizes that Mufs' accomplishment goes even further. Kaufman's larger project, as several scholars have noted, is fundamentally to provide a historical restatement of the work of the great rationalist philosopher of Judaism, Hermann Cohen. Heschel wrote not only as a scholar, but more deeply as a certain kind of chassid. Thus, Mufs was really combining Cohen's neo-Kantian rationalist Jewish theology with Hasidus. And ultimately, Mufs is creating an exquisitely balanced theology that brings together the Jewish rationalist and mystical traditions. In short, Mufs reads the Bible in order to understand and synthesize modern Jewish thought. And when Mufs reads the Bible, he is specifically reading the Biblical Critic's Bible. The basis of his way of reading is the way he contextualizes the biblical texts in their ancient Near Eastern context, the way he reads P and D and J alongside Akkadian literature. Reading it that way is precisely what allows him to create his synthesis of rationalist and mystical forms of Judaism. Again, in the case of Moshe Greenberg, I'll just describe some characteristics of his work. I'll leave it to you to relate what I'm saying to specifics of what you've read from him or what you studied with him. Greenberg sees the Bible as a Jewish book. Like Milgram, he places the Bible on a trajectory, often citing insights gleaned from the study of Akkadian and rabbinic texts on the same page of his own essay or his own commentary. It's not just that Greenberg uses Midrash as an interpretive tool. He also sees rabbinic literature as an outgrowth of the Bible's own theological system, as an expression of the Bible's own ethical ideas. Sometimes, in fact, as a more consistent expression of those ideas. And that means two things. First, Greenberg sometimes understands rabbinic literature as being more biblical than the Bible itself. Second, because rabbinic literature continues biblical thought on theological and ethical literature. You can use rabbinic literature to understand the Bible because they're part of a single cultural trajectory. Again, in precisely the same way that you can use the Code of Hammurabi to help understand biblical law because they're also part of a single cultural trajectory. For Greenberg, the Bible is best understood as part of a trajectory, or we might say part of a tradition. One doesn't just read the Bible by itself. Greenberg is not a Protestant rejecting tradition. One doesn't just read Rashi or the Bible through Rashi. Greenberg is not a certain kind of Orthodox Jew. Rather, one reads the Bible together with tradition and also on its own cultural grounds in the ancient Near East. Greenberg is not so much middle of the road as he is both and. He reads the Bible on its own ground and also through a rabbinic lens. And he demonstrates how doing the latter can end up helping the former. That is, reading the Bible through a rabbinic lens can sometimes help us understand the Bible in its ancient Near Eastern context even better. In his tendency to be both and, rather than just middle of the road, I think that Greenberg is a banner example of a conservative Jew. He's not middle of the road, but he's succeeding on being on both sides of a polarity. Indeed, he succeeds in showing that it's not really a polarity at all. The same may be said of all three of the scholars I've discussed today. It's not that they were being religious Jews and also biblical critics. It's not that they were being religious Jews in spite of being biblical critics. Rather, they were religious Jews in part through being biblical critics, because they showed how modern methods of study show the Bible to be relevant to modern Judaism. And thus, they provide a crucial example of how being fully critical and intellectually honest is an important way of being a serious, committed Jew. Yehi Zichram Baruch.